You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Exciting month in terms of finding organic molecules out in space, but we shouldn't get too excited. This is not Little Green Men. This is not aliens.
No, that's right. It's not novelty-shaped carrots either. Yeah. It's something very much more basic than that, but still very important in our understanding of the universe and potential for exobiology.
So what do we mean by organic molecule?
So an organic molecule is essentially anything that has carbon, hydrogen and oxygen in it. That's what we think of as, you know, the potential building blocks for life. They can build a whole load of other things as well. Like if you think organic chemistry, it's that sort of thing, rather than not using pesticides to grow carrots.
So the oil we fry our onions in is an organic chemical, essentially, right?
So the oil,
I'm pretty sure, is not alive.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah,
I hope not when I fry it. But we can be talking very, very basic compounds as well. But we can also talk in quite complex,
yeah, like amino acids or things like that. What we're talking about here isn't amino acids. It's not proteins. It's not those sort of advanced markers of life, which would just be wonderful to see. But they are the precursors to that, the things that you have to have in order to have life.
Now, in terms of organic molecules and knowing where they are in the solar system, therefore, maybe where there were the possibility of perhaps forming life or creating the building blocks for life, the big place people have often looked is Mars, of course. And one of the things people want to know is, was Mars a long time ago, billions of years ago, was it habitable? Were there the right conditions for life? We know, thanks to Spirit and Opportunity, that there was water. We now know, thanks to Curiosity from a few years ago, that there were some various chemical elements down below the ground. So the elements that make up these organic molecules, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur, all these kind of things that we think are important for life. But it's just done some more analysis of all the tests it's done over the last few years to find that, yes, there were these organic compounds there in Mars's early history, which is exciting.
Yeah, that's right. That's a really, it is really good to see that type of thing. It's not a fossil of a Martian dinosaur,
yeah.
But it is good also from the point of view of if you wanted to colonize Mars, you know that then the soil, or rather the regolith, the top surface of Mars, has good nutrients in it for us to grow things if humans decided that they wanted to go and become Martian colonists.
This is something that we've been trying to do as Martian explorers, if you like, robotic explorers, have been trying to do for decades now, is to look for the signs of life or the signs of the building blocks of life. I mean, way back from the Viking probes in the 1970s and then onwards through the decades. And the problem that the Viking probes have, it's thought, and then other probes have had this, the Phoenix lander in 2008, I think, discovered something called perchlorates, which are a type of salt. And they, when you try and detect these organic molecules, the perchlorates mask your signature. The Curiosity team have managed to overcome that by just making things hotter, cooking them to higher temperatures.
Hitting it with a bigger hammer.
Yeah. This is part of the advantage on Curiosity having gone with its geochemistry set, if you like. It's set of geochemistry experiments that it can run, taking samples across the surface, and it's hopefully going to do more. I think its drill was broken for a while. Basically its drill bit was giving them problems, and they've managed to figure out how to make it work again and continue drilling on Mars, because it's the subsurface of Mars which is really important for these tests rather than the surface itself.
Yeah, it's quite an incredible feat to fix something that is at such a huge distance without any human intervention.
Yeah.
You have to be really crafty, because you've basically got everything that's on the surface, but you can't use all of it. You can only use the bits that you have software to control, or you can reprogram different things to control that. So a lot of repurposing, but also a lot of ingenuity. This is where engineers really come into their own for finding interesting ways around broken bits.
And Mars itself is currently a not particularly nice place to be, or at least large swathes of the surface. There's currently a large, not quite planet scale, but covering a large fraction of the planet, a dust storm covering Mars. Now, Curiosity is is controlled, is powered by a radioisotope thermal generator, a little mini nuclear power plant on the back. So a little bit of extra dust doesn't bother it. But the other probe on Mars, Opportunity, is solar powered. And dust in the atmosphere is not good for solar power at all. It tends to block out the sun. So fingers crossed Opportunity survives.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that moment when we were all waiting for Rosetta to wake up. And Rosetta had, you know, just enough power to go to sleep and then wake back up again. Where at this stage with Opportunity that it does keep waking up, but each time you wonder, is this going to be the last time?
So as we record this, I don't think they've heard from it in a few days. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It has this low power mode where its clock sets itself a little alarm clock to wake up once per sol, once per Martian day, check whether it's got enough power to send a signal back to Earth. If it hasn't, go back to sleep and wake up the next day and see if it's got enough power. And it'll continue doing that until it's got enough power. And the only thing it's doing besides that little alarm clock running that power check is keeping the heaters running to keep it warm enough. It has to stay above about minus 50 degrees C, I think, that kind of temperature. Otherwise, its electronics break.
I suppose that's one of the good things about, you know, from heavy dust cloud or even any sort of cloud, it'll insulate. So a cloudless night is colder than a cloudy night. So that's really something that is like the silver lining or the red-coloured lining in that cloud.
Yeah. So fingers crossed Opportunity manages to survive this dust storm. This could last for days, it could last for weeks, it could last for months. These things can be very long-lived. But hopefully Opportunity will make it out the other side, as it were, and then continue operations into the future. So good luck with that Opportunity. We talked earlier about organics on Mars. There are other places in the solar system we've got organics, organic molecules. One of those is Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt, called a dwarf planet. And it wasn't really expected necessarily to find things like organics on these dry lumps of rock.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Ceres is probably one of the only planets that was discovered by a priest as well.
Yeah.
I think it was Palazzo discovered it in
1801.
That's right. And it was discovered in advance of, as well, certainly Pluto and probably Neptune as well.
Predated Neptune, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's that was one of the reasons that I was actually very pleased that Pluto was demoted, if you like, but Pluto joined Ceres in becoming a dwarf planet. So Ceres is very, very large as an asteroid. We tend to think of asteroids as being lumps of rock, but Ceres is indeed a lump of rock, but it is a ball. It is spherical.
It's about 1,000 kilometres across, so it's nearly half the size of our moon.
Yeah, exactly. So a sizable thing that really has its own gravity. So it's like a moon. It's certainly, I think, bigger than both of Mars's moons. Mm. Which are also strange shapes. They're potato shapes, not balls. So Ceres, a very interesting object in its own right, and now has organic compounds on it, organic molecules, which makes it even more interesting.
And these organic molecules, I think the latest analysis has been actually, there's possibly more than was expected before, or more than been determined before, because of exactly what kind of organic molecules you think it might be. I mean, there's lots of different flavours, I suppose. But
we're just looking at light, remember? So we've got very little to go on. We can see a signature. We can see a fingerprint in a special sort of picture called a spectrum. We split light out into its different colours. And you can see fingerprints of different atoms and molecules in this. And you're not necessarily looking at the molecule that you want to find. You might be looking at one which is associated with that. And so you might be seeing something that isn't quite what you want to be looking for, but you're assuming that there, by finding this one thing, you will also find this other thing. So you've got to be quite careful with what your assumptions are there. So if it's it might be that there's a strange sort of organic compound on there, or we may have found more of a normal sort of organic compound. It's quite difficult to say, really.
Yeah, and we don't know whether these organic compounds on these airless hunks of rock are anything like the organic compounds we get on Earth, or whether they're exactly the same, at least. They could be quite different. The study goes on. The Dawn spacecraft has been orbiting Ceres since 2015 now, I think. It's been there for a long time. Gradually lowering its orbit and then increasing its orbit. It's not got enough fuel to go anywhere else, so it'll just stay going around Ceres, I guess.
It'll probably end up in a similar way to Rosetta, and we'll end up sitting on the surface at some point.
Yes, in a possibly not that calm landing. If we're talking about organic molecules and therefore being the potential building blocks for life elsewhere, the other thing you need is those blocks for those things to build on, so you need planets themselves. And the ALMA telescope, which is a large array of small radio telescopes in the Atacama Desert down in Chile, about 60 of them, has made its first planet detections. We know of about 3,000 planets outside our own solar system. The number is going up every day, so by the time we listen to this, it's undoubtedly more. But ALMA has detected its first ones. Now, ALMA doesn't look at visible light. It looks at radio waves or infrared waves. It looks at very long wavelength light, which shows us different things out in space.
Yeah, it's looking at very cold things out in space. So you can imagine if you looked at a person with a thermal camera, you'll see a signature. Now, a thermal camera wouldn't be sensitive enough to see these type of things that we're looking at in space, because it's looking at things that are much, much colder. It's looking at things which are much colder, I think, than Herschel would have been able to have seen.
Yeah, very, very long wavelength. Yeah.
The problem that you've got when you're looking for exoplanets is that you're looking for something that is very small next to something very bright, if you were to look at them in visible light. But in radio light, you're looking at, you have a star which is glowing, but a star is very hot. And so a star doesn't appear in quite the same way as it does in visible pictures. A star will actually be quite dim in infrared light and radio waves, compared to a planet, which is absorbing some of that heat and radiating a little bit of it. And so it's actually easier to detect planets from that point of view, but then you've got the problem of resolution. And with radio telescopes and infrared telescopes, resolution is really the big problem. You've got something that's very small as well as being very faint next to something very large and very bright. And how you manage that actually is quite tricky. Now, ALMA, as you just pointed out, is an array of about 60 telescopes. And by using a technique called interferometry, you can use all of those 60 telescopes as one very large telescope or individual telescopes and get a very, very high precision image of that region of space. And you can pick out interesting features.
Now, it's not quite got the resolution to actually see planets directly, see the planet itself, but it can see interesting patterns going on in the material surrounding the star. The star it's looked at goes by the catchy name or telephone number of HD163296. So remember that. and it's a very young star. It's only about 4 million years old, which compared to our sun, which is about 4 or 5 billion years old, so it's a thousandth the age of our sun. It's a little bit more massive, a little bit heavier, but it's very young still. And it's surrounded by this disk of dust and gas. The disk of dust has been seen before to have these concentric rings, which are thought to be rings made by moons carving out, planets rather, carving out gaps in the dust ring, a bit like we see gaps in Saturn's rings being carved out by moons around Saturn. Now, what ALMA has then done, what the teams using ALMA, two different teams in fact, have looked at not the dust but the gas, and they've looked at carbon monoxide gas to look at the way that gas is distorted by the presence of planets. You expect this gas to go around the star in this nice pattern, but if there's a planet there, the gravitational pull of the planet will distort the flow of that gas, and that's the signature they've seen to imply that these planets are there. They're quite big. They're one or two times the size of Jupiter, or one or two times the mass of Jupiter, at least. And they're orbiting much, much further out than the planets we see in our solar system. The nearest planet they found is 80 times further from its star than the Earth is from the sun. So that puts it at about twice the distance to kind of Neptune, Pluto, that kind of sail. So much, much larger than our own solar system. But really exciting to have found these planets using this, I say new telescope, it's a few years old now, but this new method as well. So
yeah, it's very interesting that obviously this method is limited by the resolution. So this is the type of size scale that it can see, and that's why it's finding planets that are this far out, because anything smaller than that would just be lost, because it can't see down to those sort of distances away from the star. But it's very interesting that there do exist planets that are so far away from the star. And it's actually an interesting question whether planets, like in our solar system, we tend to think that the planets' positions, although they all orbit and are going around, it's like they're on tracks and they're more or less fixed. But actually, it's entirely plausible that planets will migrate inwards and outwards over time. And the arrangement of planets will change. So what as this solar system evolves, it might be that these planets migrate so that they get closer to their star as time goes on. And potentially, if there are smaller planets or other planets that are closer to the star, they may be knocked out, even not just switch places, but they might be catapulted out into deep space.
I think one of the reasons it's exciting for me is that we now know thousands of planets around other stars, and we keep finding these planetary systems with weird arrangements of planets or arrangements of planets that are very different to our own solar system, and saying, oh, I wonder how that formed. Whereas now with ALMA and with future space telescopes and ground-based telescopes, we're going to start seeing those planetary systems forming in methods like this. And so we can actually start to answer some of the questions about how you get to these weird and wonderful arrangements. And that's a very exciting prospect as well. You're listening to Pythagorean Astronomy. Now, a few weeks ago, we welcomed to Cardiff a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Barry Barish, who was one of the scientists who founded the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. As regular listeners to Pythagorean Astronomy will remember, LIGO made the first direct detection of gravitational waves a few years ago. Barry's been involved with the experiment for several decades, and as such, was one of three recipients of the Nobel Prize in Physics for 2017 for his significant contribution to the detection of gravitational waves. Barry was in town to give a public talk, part of the launch of the Gravity Exploration Institute here at Cardiff University. While he was here, I teamed up with one of our postgrad students, Jenny Millard, who's also a presenter on the Awesome Astronomy podcast. We grabbed some time with Barry and spoke about all things LIGO. Here's what happened when Jenny and I spoke to him about his initial role in the project.
You started with LIGO in 1994. You became PI in 1994, and you implemented a bunch of technological changes, as far as I'm aware. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I guess I was intellectually connected and connected through my institution before, so I didn't come walking off the street or something.
Yeah.
I had been one of the few people that had pushed us to develop an experimental effort in gravitational waves at Caltech, although it wasn't going to be me because I was working in particle physics. As I knew the problem was one of the big ones that we could attack. I thought, and this is after this when I got involved, was after this false start was made with bars, and interferometers were beginning, and I thought that that had a real future. And so I was interested in it from that standpoint. I came in 1994. I won't talk about that, but it had growing pains, let's say. And I came in. As you can tell from my earlier comments, I believe in technology. I think it's the big tool that we have. It's great. It's not, we like to think it's all in our minds, you know, we just have the great ideas and go do things. But there's a lot of people, a lot of time, and people before us that did things. It's not all ideas. And we happen to be living in a time where technologies are really the crucial thing. So when I came in, what was important to me was to make sure that in LIGO, we were working on the technologies that in the long run were going to really pay off. Just like interferometry was the right technology, not.
Yeah.
And so that some may sound boring, but it was important. This is 1994. We didn't have laser pointers, lasers, and CDs, and so
on. But even the computing power back in 1994 as well.
We didn't have the computing power, and we didn't have. So I'll give two examples of what I did, which was the idea was. Technologies are going to move forward. You have to think forward looking and not get yourself outdated.
Anticipate what's going to come.
So the first thing was lasers. So lasers were new, not what you're used to now, or you have a little one you can play in, and your CD player works by it and so forth. In 1994, that wasn't true. The best lasers around were gas lasers, and that's what they were going to use in LIGO, was gas lasers. And I knew enough to know that those lasers were limited, and so you had to make lasers that were made from solid-state lasers, which weren't really developed yet. So I switched to a solid-state laser immediately, the best that we could do at that stage, which is called neodymium YAG, works in the infrared. It immediately caused me problems as a leader because the people who had worked on the interferometers so far before I came were people who knew about interferometers, so they basically like to move around all the little lenses and so forth and watch the beams either hit them or miss them or whatever. Instead, the solid state lasers are in the infrared. You can't see them with your own eye.
So suddenly they want to do totally different things.
But of course, my background, as you pointed out, came from particle physics, and we never see the particles.
Yeah.
So we're used to
it. So it's old hat for you. You don't need to see it.
So for me, that didn't make any difference. It caused me social problems, as I said, because they weren't used to it. Yeah. But the main thing was that it was forward looking, and that turned out to be true. I won't say everything I do turns out to be true, but that one turned out to be true. The second, which is similar, I'm sitting next to this fancy analog device that is going to do anything you want with sound. The way these interferometers are very tricky, and there's a lot of variables that you have to control to make it work right, to work as an interferometer. And any interferometer that had been built in the world at that point had used analog controls. But again, I knew that wasn't the future.
So when you say analog controls, is that literally someone sitting there fiddling with dials?
Well, that's the human part, but there's dials to fiddle with. They're dials, just like when you had you have this thing here, somebody plays around with the dials instead of a laptop
automatically doing it.
And it's not digital. So I knew that, and once it's digital, you can put logic into it.
Yeah.
Here you've got some human person that thinks he knows what to twist.
Yeah.
And so I made the radical change to digital. There were other changes, but those are two illustrations. But for me, it wasn't that I was so brilliant that I had some great new idea. It was more something that's crucial for success and something that's long-term, and you're going to make this big complicated experiment, and that is to use technologies that you're going to be able to build on and make work in the future.
Barry had much, much more to say than that. And in fact, Jenny and I spoke to him for over an hour. If you want to hear more of that interview, then it's available on the website at pythagastro.uk as a bonus episode this month. Do go check it out. Well, Edward, it's going to be an exciting summer. And in fact, the exciting summer for you starts very soon because it's Asteroid Day.
Yes, Asteroid Day on the 30th of June. So this is a birthday event, if you like. This is an anniversary of the Tunguska event, which happened in Tunguska, which is in Siberia, in 1908. So it is now the 110th anniversary of that. And there's a foundation called the B612 Foundation. If you know the Little Prince, that is the, or Le Petit Prince, that is the asteroid that the Little Prince lives on. They started this idea of Asteroid Day to raise awareness of the potential of asteroid impacts and to make sure it's partly a lobbying group, partly a public awareness group, but it's to make people, you know, aware of the really present danger of asteroid impacts and get people involved in the task of monitoring them and following them up. So this is something that I do as part of my job with Las Cumbres Observatory, is to follow up and monitor asteroids that have been discovered, or potential asteroids which have been discovered by observers all around the world and then reported to the Minor Planet Center. But you can be involved in this. We are tracking an asteroid on a website that we made called Asteroid Tracker. And you can trigger observations on Las Cumbres Observatory by going to asteroidtracker.lco.global.
So if you're listening to this before the 30th of June, do go and take part in that. If you're listening to this after the 30th of June...
We'll run it for a week after.
Okay, so there's still chance to go and take part in that. In asteroid news around the solar system, we have the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft, which is a Japanese spacecraft, is on its way to asteroid Ryugu, which is out in the asteroid belt. And Hayabusa 2 is going to attempt to do what Hayabusa did, which is land and get a sample of the asteroid. It's getting ever closer. It's got a picture of what looks to be a Borg cube, which is a little bit concerning. So hopefully it is actually just a lump of rock. Towards the end of June and early July, it's going to take lots more images and get closer. And then over the next few months, we'll slowly spiral inwards and get lower and lower before trying to take samples and get them back to Earth. So exciting to get more samples from asteroids.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, really, that now we seem to be in an era where we can do that type of thing, that we can take a little scrape off something that is millions of miles away and actually analyse it. Mm. It's quite magical, really.
So we'll try and keep you posted over the summer of the developments with with Hayabusa 2 and its mission. That's it for this month. Don't forget that for Asteroid Day, you can visit asteroidtracker.lco.global. And for past episodes, then visit pythagastro.uk. You'll also find that extended interview with Professor Barry Barish. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.